Sit down and buckle up. It's time for the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Pirate Monk Podcast. Hey, this is Nate. I'm here with Aaron. If you have been listening week after week to the podcast, there have been some other voices, great voices. Other pirate monks have been introducing the interviews, but this week, Aaron and I are back, and I'm happy to be back. How you doing, Aaron?
I'm happy to be back. Don't ask. I'm having technological problems tonight, and it's making me feel aggravated.
Yeah, well, you're the technical genius. You're the guy who makes all this stuff go. So when you're having trouble, that's a sign that something is going sideways.
It's unfortunately more common than our listeners probably know. Man, it's so frustrating. Okay, here's my gratitude thing. Because right, with any addiction feelings, mm-hmm. Oh, gratitude is so important. Yeah. So I think back to times when we tried to do this, where I would record on my computer, you would record with Mondo on another computer mm-hmm. in Nashville, and then we would try to sync it up. But then most people don't know that the recordings don't exactly align by the millisecond. So we mm-hmm. would have to keep scooching it over throughout, like it was hours and hours to sync up the audio when we started doing this.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it sucks right now. I'm a little annoyed that the technology is not working, but it does not suck at all compared to the normal for what we used to do. So I am grateful for the technology that now exists, and that will make me feel better soon. I fucking hope.
All right. Well, hey, Aaron, you've made another trip across the country. You have a habit of doing this. You were out in California for a bit. You drove both directions, right?
I did. Well, I drove a good 75 hours in 8 days. Oh, unfortunately, during some very freezing temperatures. But hey, it's cool. I'm still a road dog. I can still do 19 hours on the first stretch and 16 on the second. I can go from Tennessee to California in 2 days.
I cannot. Allie and I leave in 2 days for Florida. We're going down, as we always do this time of year, for 6 weeks. I'll be visiting a bunch of pirate monks while I'm down there. But, it's an 11-hour trip. I'm not even going to do that in 1 day. I'm going to put Allie on a plane. I'm going to get the dog, and I'm going to stop halfway there. Well, That's where I am.
I will say on the way back, I did take 3 days, because on the second day, all of the truck drivers that I ran into had been forced to not drive at night because of the freezing temperatures and frozen roads and ice. Uh-huh. And so when I ran into them, I thought, well, if the professional drivers are being forced to stop, I should probably grab a hotel in Little Rock.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I woke up in the morning and found out Little Rock was way closer to home than I thought. So that was that was great. Yeah, I don't know. It's just driving. And and you know what? I love that there is voice to text. I got to work on so many things. I've got pages and pages I haven't sent to you on thoughts that I had for Samson. I would just talk to myself. I talk to myself for no benefit so often. And so, I was hoping it would be good.
Well, I talk to myself a lot only because I find myself to be an absolutely intriguing conversationalist. So,
and nobody interrupts. It's so good. Go ahead.
While you were driving, I was doing something I haven't done in a while in the U.S. I took the train. I had to go up to Pennsylvania, Lebanon, Pennsylvania, to shoot some video with our friends Sam Black, and Matt Wenger was there, and a guy who I guess we have not had on, but we'll have him on shortly. Troy and Melissa Haas were there. Let me see who else. Oh, David Murrow. We'll get him on the show too.
You were shooting video. What does that mean? I'm trying to picture it.
Yeah. Well,
in cabaret doing some like high I don't know.
No, this was Sam Black's brainstorm, I think, but he got the cooperation of another great guy who we'll have on the show shortly, Roy Smith. You're going to love Roy. Man, we stayed at his house. Christian psychologist who runs Pennsylvania Counseling Service up there. And the idea was we were going to create a lot of content around porn addiction and recovery for church leaders, pastors and church leaders, explaining the addiction and explaining the recovery process and also explaining betrayal trauma. So it was 3 days of shooting in a very, very top-notch professional studio. So full crew, hair and makeup, lights, multiple cameras, the whole doggone deal.
How was that for you?
I have to tell you this. I will tell you that to get there, I flew to Philly and then took the train to Harrisburg, which is something I haven't done for a while. Let me tell you what happened, Aaron. The first day was hell. I experienced, out of the blue, an anxiety attack. The first one I have experienced since. I'd forgotten about this one. I had one. It happened to me my junior year in college. I was in Montreal for a speech and debate tournament, the Transatlantic University Speech and Debate Association. So competing against university students from around the English-speaking world. It was 6 events over 3 days. It was the last day, the last event. I didn't know it, but I was leading in the points. Right before I went up for the last event, which was an extemporaneous event, they give you your topic on your way to the lectern, and you got to speak for 10 minutes. My coach leaned over and said, "You're in the lead." I stood up. They called my name. I took the slip that had my topic on it, walked to the front, turned around, looked at the room, and froze. My brain would not work. I stammered for a few minutes and then sat down and came in second in the tournament. Now, I'd forgotten all about that, and nothing like that has happened since. Lord knows how many times I've talked. Well, this time I was on tap to do 4 talks total, plus be in a number of panel discussions. And on top of that, Sam on the first day wanted me to record, because I've never recorded this in a studio, the Samson and David talk, which I've only done 1,000 times. Everybody else was working with a teleprompter, and I did have teleprompter notes for my other talks, but I decided for this, I've got it cold. And so it was toward the end of the first day. Troy had shot some, Sam had done some, Matt Wenger had done some, he was there, and they were killing it. And I think that intimidated me a little bit. They were doing so well. So I got, you know, I went in hair and makeup and I got under the lights and they, you know, it's camera action, the whole deal. And I got rolling and I was about 10 minutes in and I lost my place. I stopped, reset, restarted again. 5 minutes later, I lost my place again. And I'm starting to get anxious. And I'm also feeling a tremendous amount of shame and embarrassment that this is happening to me. Because I was quite convinced that, you know, I was easily the most gifted speaker there, and this was just going to be a piece of cake. And then it just got worse and worse. So we stopped. I got up, walked around, people speaking soothingly and reassuring to me, telling me I'm doing fine. No, don't worry. We've got editing. I take a drink. I come back. And now my brain won't work. I can't put a sentence together. I can't remember what I've said. I don't know. So we quit for the day. Went back to Roy Smith's house that night, and then I crammed for the next day. I got up the next morning, and God bless Roy Smith. He came downstairs, and he said, "Nate, I woke up in the middle of the night, prayed for you. Before we go today," he says, "I want to talk to you about yesterday. What do you think happened?" And I said, "Well, I think pride got me and shame, and I was just drowning in shame." And he said, "Well, I think that's bullshit."
Ah, I love it.
He didn't say those.
Go on.
Yeah. He didn't use those words, but essentially that's what he said. He said, you wanted to do a good job and you were having a hard time doing a good job. And that's not pride and that's not shame. He said, what I saw from the back of the room was I saw you had an anxiety attack. And he said, I've had them myself. I know. He said, I saw your breathing get shallow. I saw that look in your eyes. And what happened was he's explained neurologically and chemically what's going on, this spike of adrenaline. And at some point when that fight or flight kicks in, your brain shuts down. You're now solely on instinct and forget, rational cognitive thought.
Yeah.
And he said, I'll bet you're afraid it's going to happen again, aren't you? And I said, exactly. I've been, And he said, well, be prepared. When you go in, there will be a little bit of surge of anxiety, and that's natural. What should have happened yesterday, he said the director didn't pick up on it, and he said, and I didn't want to interfere, but they should have pushed you all the way through yesterday. Today, you're going to finish the talk. When you start to feel the anxiety, take a deep breath and don't back off, move toward it. And once you get over the hump, you'll be fine. And you know what, Aaron, he was right. I finished up strong. Then I knocked out the other three. I was on top of it. Then we did the panels and I was all in. But it was a humbling experience. And now I'm grateful for the experience because, I don't talk a lot about, Allie's challenges on here, but Allie has experienced and still from time to time will have these anxiety attacks. And I have not been the most empathetic partner, my tendency has just to say, don't worry about it. There's nothing to worry about, mm-hmm. And I think I've shamed Allie a little bit over those anxiety attacks. Now, I'll tell you what, next time it happened, I'm going to be a whole lot more like Roy Smith was. I'm going to be empathetic and I'm going to, I can empathize.
And I immediately want to pull up mm-hmm. how many assumed heart attacks per year in America. I'm sure we could do other countries, but just in America.
Yeah.
End up being anxiety attacks.
Sure. Yeah.
Because they are more common than people assume. And especially when we get in those situations, I have not had that experience, but I've experienced things in the middle of the night that are so similar.
Yeah.
Where that's my one horrible time. If I wake up and my brain's like, here's all the things that are screwed up in your life that you can't get in front of. And I get so locked up.
Yep.
And that actually happened two nights ago where I went to sleep early. I wanted a good night's sleep. And then someone locked the back door and my daughter called me when she got done with work.
Mm-hmm.
Late shift. She works at a bookstore and they were doing a book signing in Nashville. She got home at like 1:30 and then I was just done. I could not go back to sleep because every time I tried, I would get locked up with here's all the anxiety. And in the middle of the night, the anxiety is so much worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know that that's the same thing as a panic attack per se, but I know there are a lot of people that end up in the hospital thinking they are having a heart attack and they're just feeling those things. And it's,
I'll tell you,
it's not shame. It's not a lot of things. It's here's the full load being dumped on you at this moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And I spun into worst case scenario thinking as I'm walking around and I started seriously to doubt my sanity. And here's the thought that came to my head. My mother spent the last year of her life in a mental hospital. Maybe this is it. Maybe I just snapped. Maybe it's over. It's done. I'm done. This is it.
Wait. So you were thinking maybe I'm being like my mom, even though
you are
so much older than she was at that point.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But this is it. I've just, out of nowhere, I have lost the thread of sanity. I actually went that far, and that's, you know, and I think under, you know, in that state, when we lose capacity for really balanced, rational thought, because that part of the brain is not operating, these kind of crazy things can sound plausible. Did to me.
Yeah. When we go to that amygdala, where it's the flight, fight, freeze stuff, there's no prefrontal cortex thought. It's just, I feel all of this and hear the few pieces of information driving it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really hard in those moments to just say, oh, I'll rationally climb out of it. We don't just rationally climb out of it.
And I'll tell you what, having Roy come down, sit with me, talk with me, pray with me. When he was done, Troy Haas came over and prayed with me. Having those brothers there, I don't know that I would have been able to finish the, I don't think I would have been able to finish the taping otherwise. I was so wound up. I needed my brothers to come and get me at that point.
It's, wow.
So, yeah.
That's a lot, man.
Yeah.
But you... You said you're glad for it, so I'll be glad for you that you walked through it, and it's good for you and Allie. I don't know what else to say about it, except that that's hard, and I wonder how many other listeners go through that, possibly on a far more regular basis than you have.
Yeah, I'd love to hear some stories. Meanwhile, while I was up there, I was out of pocket, and I really wanted to be in on the conversation with Greg Oliver because he's one of my favorite people in the world. But you went ahead and talked with Greg. I'm assuming it was a good conversation?
Well, I don't know. I got a little nervous and didn't have a lot. No, sorry. Of course. I love Greg. Greg's awesome. Yeah. Well, you know what? Let's just take a moment. Let's take a breath and... Let's listen to this interview with Greg and what's happening with him, because it's been a while since we talked to him.
Hey, let's take just a moment to mention LifeWorks Counseling, our sponsor here on the Pirate Monk Podcast. This is Roan and Eva and Ro Hunter, working out of Madison, Mississippi, but serving the entire country. Well, these days, I don't think they're even restricted to the U.S. But whether you are an individual needing help or whether you need help as a couple, these are the folks who really know men's issues, women's issues, experts in recovery from sexual addiction, extramarital affairs, sexual brokenness of all kinds, porn addiction, false intimacy. They also can provide a therapy for depression and anxiety or for anger issues. And they are equipped to help with spiritual formation and soul care. In fact, Roan and Eva will even work as a couple with a couple. If your marriage is at a spot where you really need some people who've been through the wars themselves and come out the other side, there's no better equipped couple to help you than Roan and Eva Hunter. There's also coaching available, so you can work either with a certified sex addiction therapist, a certified marriage and family counselor, or with a certified coach. And you can do it directly in person or online. The way to find out more is to go to lifeworks.ms. Lifeworks.ms, that's LifeWorks Counseling.
Welcome back to the Pirate Monk Podcast. We've got Greg Oliver with us. Greg, how long has it been since you were on the show last?
It has been about 9 years, I think. It's been a long time.
I was trying to figure that out. 9 years. That is great. And your life is exactly the same as it was 9 years ago.
Exactly. Every single day of the last 2,800 days looks identical. Yeah.
It was super fun getting to catch up with you at the summit back in November.
Yeah, it was great for me too.
Getting some face-to-face time. So for those of you that don't know, Greg is the executive director of Awaken, which is a gospel-based 12-step program. Program, is that the right word for it? I don't know.
Sure.
Sure.
We'll go to program.
But that focuses on sexual brokenness. So since many of our listeners might not know you, and anyone that starts something like that, man, there's got to be a story as to how you got there. So give us the Greg Oliver story.
Yeah, for me, that just, you know, sex addiction recovery is where I heard all the money is. So that's a joke.
Mm-hmm. And it's just fun.
Yeah, so like a lot of people who do work in addiction recovery, whether it's as a therapist or as a community leader or a coach or whatever, my experience in Awaken came out of just my own story. At the time that we're recording this, I'm 53 years old. I've been in recovery from sexual addiction myself for the last 15 years. And so at age 38, my life kind of came to a kind of a screeching halt in the same way that those crash test dummy cars do against a wall. a lot of the secrets that I had been keeping for a very long time were revealed. I was serving in full-time ministry as a worship and music pastor at the time and had been doing that for about 15 years while trying to juggle the parts of my story that nobody knew, including my wife. And man, just the longer I tried, the more unsuccessful it got, the more away from me it got, and the more my behavior escalated and got out of control. And, you know, for a long time, like a lot of people that I talked to, my prayers were kind of in the realm of, God, please take this away. Please just fix me, cure me, deliver me. And kind of by the end, the prayers, when I did pray about it, were more like, God, just let this be over, like whatever that looks like. I mean, if it means me getting caught, whatever. And when I tell people that sometimes I would pray to get caught, they're like, oh my gosh, that's such a brave prayer. And I'm like, not really, because I can look back now and see that I was fully in like addict brain, which, you know, when I say addict brain, I mean like a thought process where there's a lot of manipulation and control moves going on. And I think at the time I was actually trying to manipulate God and thinking if I prayed this super like brave prayer of let me get caught, that maybe God would just really respect that bravery and wouldn't let me get caught, but would just fix me instead. And it, you know, I look back on that now and I'm like,
aren't those prayers so funny when we go back and see those kinds of like, I was trying to manipulate God by like spinning this around. Like it's amazing when we're out of our minds, how out of our minds we can be.
I mean, it's funny now. At the time it made perfect sense because insanity makes sense to an insane person. And in that part of my life, that's totally how I was living. And thankfully, God could tell the difference, and he could tell that even though that prayer isn't what I really wanted, it was what I really needed. And I was never going to be, I don't believe that I was ever going to be the guy who said, I can't live with this anymore. I'm raising my hand and I'm saying, hey, I got to confess that I got a problem. I was too terrified of that. So being exposed was the way that it had to happen, and that's how it happened with me.
So where did that start for you? Why did that become your preferred self-soothing method in your life?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it's one of the right questions, because a lot of times when we are focusing on the destructive behavior, we just kind of keep all the focus on how bad it is, what you're doing now, and not like, where did that start and how did it get going? Because for me, it started as a way of comforting myself and easing anxiety. Like a lot of people who grew up in the church in the 70s and 80s, I grew up in an environment where a lot of the ways that how well you're doing as a Christian or how well you're not doing as a Christian were connected to your behavior. And I'm not saying that behavior doesn't matter, because it does, but like that seemed to be disproportionately important. And like good Christians are people who do this and don't do that. And bad Christians are people who don't do these things, but they do those things. And so I just remember that whether it was at home or at church or even at school, because I went to a Christian high school, there just was a whole lot of imbalanced perspective about just doing the right thing and looking the right way as a Christian. And I tried to do that, and but I wasn't always successful because, you know, nobody is. I wasn't able to always do it right. And so I just remember, even as a kid, even before anything about this turned sexual, just whenever I would do the wrong thing, I learned, don't let anybody find out. So always try to do the right thing, but when you do the wrong thing, don't let anybody know. And so hiding became a strategy early on. But then also, whenever the tension became too much, another thing I learned was find something to escape into. And so when I was really little, the escape would look like reading books or watching TV, just kind of escaping into a story that would make me forget whatever's going on in the here and now that was stressing me out or causing anxiety. And then when I hit puberty and discovered how to masturbate, then, I mean, that just kind of took over. I was doing the same thing. I was escaping or numbing, but now instead of reading a book or watching a show, I would just masturbate, because that still gave me the escape and comfort, but it felt a lot better. Mm-hmm. And of course, at that point, I had no way of knowing how dependent on it I was going to become and how damaging it was going to eventually be.
Yeah. How would you, like, I get it. I grew up in the same world with the, I'm judging how, quote, mature I am, or my disciple walk with Jesus based on I'm doing these things, I'm not doing these things. And like you said, behavior is important. It shows a lot of our heart. It certainly can show the substance of our faith in certain ways. So it seems like the two extremes is when you bring the gospel in, where the person and work of Jesus is absolutely enough for everything about me today. Mm-hmm. That it feels to people who are still focusing on, yeah, but behaviors are important, like you're now giving license to sin.
Right.
Of course, this goes all the way back to Paul. I mean, he has to bring it up. You think I'm saying that sin's going to get worse because grace is abounding? Of course not. Right. But it shows that they were thinking the same question back then.
Yeah.
So how would you, if I could time warp you back to that kid, how would you explain the function of behavior?
Yeah.
And the safe haven of the gospel? How would you explain it to him?
Golly, that's a good question, Aaron. I don't think that I would want to remove the encouragement or the challenges to good behavior. It's not so much that I would take away everything that was said. I think I would add stuff to it that wasn't said. Mm. And I think the stuff that wasn't said as much is, hey, when you disobey, or when you, excuse me, when you make a wrong choice, or when you sin, that has consequences, but my love for you never changes. God's love for you never changes. God doesn't think any less of you when you do a bad thing than when you do a good thing. And so, like, you're safe, and I will never leave you, and, you know, I'll never love you any less if you do something wrong. But, you know, when you do wrong things, it's hurtful, and so we have to address them. So I think it's just showing both sides of that. And the thing, like, to be kind and to be understanding and fair to, like, our caregivers, whether that was teachers or parents or pastors or whatever, you know, as an adult, I have an ability to grasp the nuances of that. And I don't remember as much that I didn't have the ability to think in the abstract like that when I was a kid. Things are so much more absolute and concrete when you're a kid. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you're constantly, and I was constantly scanning my environment to look for body language, facial expression, tone of voice. And I could tell when I'd done something wrong, even before I knew what that thing was. Like, I could see the disappointment, and I would just, like, get a catch and a cringe. And so I think that, like, always following that would be the words of, like, hey, I'm disappointed in you. I think that's one thing I would change. I really encourage parents to focus what they're evaluating on the behavior and not on the child. In other words, don't say, I'm disappointed in you. Say, I'm really sad about the choice you made. because, you know, kids are so egocentric that if we're not careful and if we don't sometimes over-explain it, they're going to find a way to make their way to a place of shame. And I know that's what I did. And I believe that that was not ever the intention of my caregivers. But that was the impact a lot of the time, because I just didn't have the capacity to process what was happening any differently. And had they done everything exactly the way that I'm describing it now, I probably still would have struggled with that. But I think it would have been a little easier because I would have had a competing message, and I would have had that continuous reminder that even when you do it wrong, I'm still for you and I still love you. And so when we've got to do a consequence, it's not because I'm angry. It's not because I want to punish you. It's because I want what's best for you. And this is going to help you learn.
I really wish I had been given the language much earlier that we now use when we do perfect father work, where I wanted to think through, can God ever be disappointed in me?
Right.
And for a long time, I just felt like, no, I can't accept that. That feels like a dangerous thought. But then I was teaching through Mark, and there were so many little moments where Jesus seems a bit, you know, exasperated with the people. How long am I going to be with you, you faithless generation? But so I had to re-engage it. And the biggest thing for me was I didn't think through the difference between being disappointed for me and disappointed in me.
Yes.
That there are things in my life that God has an emotional response to, because we saw Jesus had it. But it's not disappointed in me, because I am perfect and righteous because Jesus is enough.
That's right. But
I can still be a prince eating out of a dumpster, and my dad's like, kid, I love you. This is breaking my heart watching you eat out of the dumpster. Come back into the palace.
And this is crazy, and it's just breaking my heart that you're believing that this is what you want and what you need and what's best for you. You know, you're behaving like somebody that you used to be but are not anymore, and I want better for you.
Yeah, but oh, the difference. When God is disappointed for me, it shows he is still on my side.
Yes.
He's not removing himself because he's embarrassed by me. He's not shocked. I mean, why do some of us, I won't put it on everybody, why do some of us feel like God is surprised when we blow it? Like he's just shocked and I need some time away from you.
But what you just said has been a lot of people's experience with the caregivers who represented God in their early life.
Yeah.
Like when we're really small, nobody represents God in our lives more than our parents. And it can be our Sunday school teachers and our coaches, but the people who are authorities. And so the way that they respond to us when we blow it, we project that onto God. And so if my caregivers were shocked when I did something wrong, first off, why?
Right.
because, you know, they weren't perfect. And when we're shocked when somebody does something wrong, it's revealing that we have unrealistic expectations. And shock is different from sadness, and it's even different from frustration. I think that we see God that way because we saw other people treat us that way. The big picture that I had in my head all the time when I would come to God once again to say, forgive me, I did it again.
Yeah.
I would just see, I saw a picture of God with a disappointed look on his face, back turned to me, arms crossed, shaking his head. And you know, I've seen that somewhere before. And whether I saw it exactly that way or whether I just projected it or you know, just envisioned it that way, that's how I saw it. And Aaron, it's crazy. I'm in a community group at my church and to what we're doing right now. And we're going through Dane Ortlund's book called Deeper. Mm-hmm. And it is just blowing my mind in so many good ways. And the chapter that we just went through has a quote in it. And he says, whether you have ignored it, neglected it, it being Jesus's love, whether you've ignored it, neglected it, squandered it, misunderstood it, or hardened yourself to it, the Lord Jesus Christ approaches you today, not with arms crossed, but with arms open, the very position in which he hung on the cross.
Mm.
And I'm just like, oh, yes, thank you. I need to hear that a lot.
Well, let's bring this back to recovery work and gospel-based 12 steps. So you're working with men, your own story included in this, that when they think of their these unwanted behaviors,
right?
There can be a lot of very harsh judgment of themselves, even if other people are giving them grace. And you're trying to help them with a different lens to look through, to look at that story, to look at that behavior, to figure out how to have more compassion by understanding survival strategies. So break that down.
Yeah, I mean, I'll start by saying this. The most succinct and clear way that I ever heard this introduced was actually at one of our intensives, and it was something that Andy Gullihorn said. And I know you know Andy really well. But Andy comes to most all of our men's intensives. And when we were talking about this topic, he said so many of us, when we're finally getting to the point of sharing our stories with people, we fully expect the response to be shame on you, or how could you, or why did you? But really, a much more appropriate response would be, well, of course. Of course you did that. As I'm hearing your story and I'm hearing how things were and what you believed and what you thought you had to do, how would you not have eventually gone to something like that? And I'm like, oh my gosh, that is it. Because saying, of course, is not the same thing as saying it's okay, or it wasn't wrong, or it didn't hurt people. But like, yeah, with the capacity that you had, with the lack of having your basic emotional needs met up to that point in your life, and believing the message that if my needs are going to be met, I have to do it. Well, of course, when you were a kid, when you started believing that way, the methods that you chose were childish methods. You know, if you're a six-year-old, when you're trying to figure out what to do with your anxiety, you're not going to choose the same tactic as a 26-year-old. You're going to choose something that you have the capacity to think, okay, that makes me feel better. And so like, if you're a toddler, maybe that's sucking your thumb. If you're six, it might be losing yourself in a TV show. If you're pre-adolescent or adolescent, it might be discovering your genitals and realizing that masturbating feels comfortable. Even before you have the words for it, you found something that makes the bad feelings stop and replaces them with something that feels better. And so in my immaturity, why would I not do that every time I feel this tension inside? Well, there are answers to why would I not, but I don't know what they are, and I need people to help me understand what they are. And in the absence of people knowing, or of the absence of people engaging with us to teach us that, we're just going to keep on that track. And whatever the survival strategy is that we adopt when we're very young, it's going to grow with us. And so, like, what looked like masturbation for me when I was 11 became, you know, sneaking to rent like hard R-rated movies from the video store when I was 17 that had a lot of sex scenes. And then it turned into like finding porn magazines. And then it turned into, it grew with me. And so the delivery method of the strategy was more adult, but it was still coming from that same childish consciousness, the same belief that this is going to make the bad feelings go away and it's going to replace them with good feelings. And so, yeah, a lot of times when people have crossed so many lines and they're staring down the business end of a potential divorce, or maybe even they've broken the law and they're looking at legal consequences, man, just the shame of how in the world did I let it get this bad? What kind of a person does this? Well, the same kind of person as all of us, the same kind of person who is trying to make life work on their own, because we weren't intended to make life work on our own.
Well, and let me pause there, because when we talk about survival strategies, I think that can make a lot of people feel left out. Like, oh, I was in an abusive situation, I had some big trauma, and that was not why I jumped into sexual fantasy when I was younger. normal adolescent loneliness and no one likes me kinds of feelings, but it wasn't a big trauma, but it still became my survival strategy for pubescent time. And again, that was without access. You know, I had, my mom didn't get a Victoria's Secret magazine for about, 6 years in there, because I didn't have access to pornography. But, you know, if a Fredericks of Hollywood came in the mail, I was the boy that checked the mail every day, just in case.
So you could commandeer it if need be, if the opportunity presented itself.
So, again, it wasn't like deep end stuff right away. It didn't come from a trauma, but it was absolutely a part of adolescent survival that comforted. Yeah. And then, like you said, you carry that with you. It became different things and for different reasons at different times in my life. And so I just don't want people to feel excluded if they don't have a big trauma story attached to an unwanted behavior.
Well, can I make a statement that I think will be 100% inclusive about that?
Yes.
You said a couple of things. One of your comments was like, I didn't have any big trauma. And then another time you said, like, if somebody is like, well, I didn't have a trauma. Those are two very different statements. Yeah. You know, saying I didn't have a big trauma, a lot of people are familiar with the language of like big T and little T trauma. And that's probably something y'all have talked about on the podcast before. Mm-hmm. But like, when I'm talking about big T, little T, big T, that is like, I believe, or it's actual, that my life is in danger. Right. You know, a horrible accident, a kidnapping, rape, you know, something that like everybody would hear that had happened and like, oh my gosh, without a doubt, that is trauma. But then the little T trauma, that's the constant uncertainty or developmental trauma that so many people experience as daily and normal that they don't identify it as trauma. But really, trauma is any experience that was less than what we needed. And so if you have that broad of a definition of trauma, there's no person breathing air who has not experienced some form of trauma. Because like if you say, this is what I needed as a human being, I needed certain emotional needs to be met 100% of the time. Well, does anybody get that? No, nobody gets all of their needs met all of the time. So there's automatically a gap between what I need and what I get. And that's from being born into a fallen world, right? I mean, if those of us who are spiritual or believe the concepts in the Bible would say, well, yeah, of course. Thank you, Captain Obvious. There's a gap between what we need and what we got. That's what heaven's for. But I sense that gap early in life, and I learn what kind of things can I do to make me feel like the unmet needs are being met. Well, again, like I said a few minutes ago, I'm not going to pick the right things, but I'm going to pick something that makes me feel like it, and then it grows along with me. So everybody who's listening to this has had trauma, whether they think they have or not. And trauma could take the form of having a parent with emotional instability where you never really knew what the mood was going to be. It could be a person who grew up in a family where they had to move all the time. And like I remember there's a therapist that I know who was describing a client who talked about how they moved like 12 times before he was in the fourth grade. And the way that he would know that they were moving is when he would be riding home on the school bus and they would turn onto his street and he would see a for sale sign in his yard. And that's how he would know that they were moving again. And so like, that's a trauma. And like, it's not necessarily even something that the parents could have made not happen, but they could have mitigated the traumatic impact by communicating more, by involving the kids in the discussion more. And because he, every time he rode the school bus, every single day, he had a catch in his body right before he turned onto his street, because it's like, what if today's the day? And then it wouldn't be, and he would breathe easier. But then the next day he was right back there. Well, we can't hold trauma like that in our bodies for very long before we're going to do something to release it. And if we don't know of a healthy way to release it, we're going to find an unhealthy or a sideways way to release it.
Right. Yeah, and we have to throw out there that even if that guy's parents did a much better job, he still might have experienced trauma, because trauma isn't the thing. It's how we respond to the thing. It's on the inside of me. And so I can have the best parents in the world and still have those gap feelings that I want to fill with something that comforts me.
That's right. But if you have those parents who recognize it and they speak to it and they jump in and they respond and they intervene, research has shown that, like you said, it isn't the trauma that is the biggest problem. It is the lack of responsiveness and healing and repair from the trauma. Because like people who have a big T, like somebody who is in a horrible accident, or maybe they're attacked by a vicious dog, if they have a responsive support system and the right thing is done and safety is restored, you can actually recover from a trauma like that without having as much lingering residue as somebody who had an ongoing little T trauma that was never even acknowledged. And so you're absolutely right. It's so much about, is this named? Is this affirmed and acknowledged? I mean, at our intensives, I've heard this story more times than I would like to, and it makes me heartbroken every time, about men who, when they were boys, were molested by older boys or older siblings or cousins or neighbors or whatever. And they went home and they told their caregivers, and either they weren't believed or nothing was done about it. Nothing was said about it. And like, almost worse than keeping it as a secret would be asking for help and then not getting help. And that's such a huge, significant trauma. And like, the caregiver might be thinking, well, I didn't know what to do. Okay, that's understandable, but you've got a kid who's just trusted you with this. You got to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
And so just to have that, to feel like either I can't go to anybody for help, or to say, I tried that and it didn't work, it teaches us that, well, again, if it is to be, it's up to me. And so I got to figure this out on my own.
So again, this is has been such a theme on the show for a while. Guys hear about story work. There's Allender folks on the show.
Yes.
And I think this is obviously the reason that's so important. But I think it's also a very individual journey for people to find the right language.
Yeah.
I think in some ways it's easier to find the language with big T trauma. But on that spectrum of what I went through as a child and why, I need a vocabulary. Some people are never going to feel comfortable with the word trauma for I felt lonely and isolated, but every other seventh grader does too. So I don't feel comfortable calling that trauma. Well, okay, it really doesn't matter what's the word we're going to use, but can we connect it to, yes, I did feel this need to soothe myself, to fill that gap in my emotional experience. And then we come back to what you were talking about. How do I have greater compassion through a gospel lens for my 47-year-old self?
Right. Yeah. And like all these questions that you're asking, I think are so critical. And the reason why like I wanted to talk about that is because I've been in recovery, like I said at the beginning, for 15 years. And the language that we speak in our recovery meetings at Awaken now is, in some ways, it's very similar to things that I've been hearing and saying for 15 years, but in some ways, it's actually very different, because a lot of the language and the space of discussion in meetings that I went to early on was all about like replacing addictive behavior with recovery behavior, and like doing all the right things now, do the next right thing, and put this on your phone, and work the 12 steps. And by the way, I'm not saying anything to suggest that those are not good things to do. Particularly at the beginning of a recovery program, let's clear the decks. Let's look at everything that distracts me, and let's simplify. So let's, you know, let's look at how do I act out, and let's make it harder to act out. And yes, let's look at the chaos that my life has been like, and let's figure out a systematic way to live that's going to make more sense. But it's not because the tasks or the work is the end in and of itself. It's the means to an end. And so if I don't ever get down below the surface and figure out how it is that I started believing that my addictive behavior was what I needed, then it's just a matter of time before I return back to it. Because I think that if we're trying to heal beliefs and we're trying to heal behaviors, I think that sometimes we try it in the wrong order, whether that's in the church or in the home or in a recovery community. We may not phrase it this way, but we behave as if I fix the behavior, then it's going to take care of the beliefs. And I don't agree with that. I think that behavior comes out of belief. If I believe I'm a piece of crap, I'm going to act like a piece of crap. If I believe that God is pissed off at me and he doesn't want to hear from me, well, then I'm going to behave like someone who's an orphan and who's alone and who has to fix this himself. If I believe that if I tell anybody what I'm struggling with, they're going to reject me, then I'm going to spare myself that pain by not telling anybody anything. And so I don't fix my faulty core beliefs by cleaning up my behavior. But if I focus on coming to understand, how did I get to believe that in the first place? If I have somebody who can tell me, hey, your behaviors, even though they're wrong and they're harmful, we agree about that, they make sense. And like that right there is off-putting for some people because they don't want to hear anything affirming about their behavior because they've been beating themselves up about it. Because like, what other good choice do I have as a Christian but to beat myself senseless? Well, what if Jesus doesn't beat you senseless over your sin? You know, what if he took it on himself so that you wouldn't have to get beaten senseless? And so, hey, the thing that you did, as bad as it was, it made sense. What if we tried to figure out all the things that contributed to that and what it came to establish in your life as a set of core beliefs? And what if those core beliefs weren't accurate? What if something else was true? Like if you believed that you were deeply loved by Jesus, how would that impact your behavior? If you believe that you had a community who wouldn't walk away from you no matter what you did, how would that impact the way that you confess, you know, and put things in the light? So I think that this whole deal of being kind and compassionate and acknowledging of the strategies that we've employed is actually a really helpful way of changing behavior. And sometimes if I believe the truth about myself and about God and about the gospel, then it's going to become easier to say no to the unhealthy things and easier to say yes to healthy, connected, godly things. I mean, I'm not saying that like you don't have to do any work, but like if you realize you can't do it, but you just kind of have to surrender and let God do it and then show up, it just changes the whole ballgame. At least it has in my life.
And this goes back to what you said earlier, that you would say to your younger self that you wouldn't necessarily take the other things out, but you would add to it. And so this is, when you were talking earlier, I just remembered a conversation I had, geez, at least 15 years ago. I used to go to an atheist tea every Thursday.
Oh, wow.
Long story about how I got invited to that, but it was a group of like 15 seniors. Most of them had been professors at the college in town or worked in, anyways. So I would go, and by tea, they meant wine, but you know, whatever. You could put your wine in a teacup if you wanted. But I took a walk with the lady that initiated this group decades before, and she was kind of running down Christians and their idea of obedience and how silly that seemed to her. And I just remember saying, I don't feel that pressure. Like, obedience is not a form of slavery. That's how she was describing
it. Yeah.
To me, I know that if I am living in disobedience, that clutters the space in my heart. Obedience clears space so that I can start to enjoy and discover the love of God, my love toward God, and love of others. And I described it like dating my wife at the time that most of the times we would go on dates, romance did not happen. We would either get in an argument because we finally had time to talk about the stuff that we didn't while the kids were around. But that's okay. That wasn't a waste of time. We needed to talk about it. Often we would end up going to Costco because it was so much easier to shop without four kids. Well, that's okay. We right, needed to shop. Yeah. And then sometimes it could be romantic. But if I have in my head that obedience, even a recovery mindset of obedience, is like karma. If I do this, then I get this blessing from God. Then I'm misunderstanding, because when I'm obedient, it might just be practical that I don't have to suffer the consequences, which is like going shopping or having the argument you need to have. But what I'm hoping for is every once in a while, I get that romance, and obedience created the space for the dance. It's the dance floor.
Yeah.
And when I started thinking about it like that, especially after that conversation with that woman who articulated so well the crappy version of Christian obedience, because she was right. Yeah. That is the way it's seen. But after that, I just never thought of obedience is just practical. And when I am disobedient, it reinforces to me, yep, obedience would have been practically so much better. That wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
So anyways, well, that's how I think of that.
I love how you think about it, because it it reminds me, and it's consistent with conversations I have with people all the time, because one of the misunderstandings, or I think one of the faulty beliefs that a lot of people carry with them who struggle with compulsive behavior, is this belief that I keep doing it because I want to do it. Mm-hmm. Like if you didn't want to do it, you'd just stop, right? Well, I mean, that can be kind of blurry, because if the thing that you're doing has sexual pleasure attached, then yeah, I guess you could say there's a part of you that wants that. But deep down in your deepest desires of your emotional and spiritual core, is that giving you what your heart longs for? And I think almost every person, if you really get them thinking like that, would say no. It's like giving me a counterfeit version of what my heart wants. It's giving me just this really synthetic, you know, saccharine sugary version of it, but it's not something that nourishes or sustains me, because it's not real. When a lot of times when I'm talking to young single guys whose struggles are, at least to that point in their life, limited to compulsive masturbation and pornography, if it's somebody who's really like beating themselves up and saying, I guess I just want to do this so much. I mean, I guess that's just who I am. I'm like, well, you're sounding like you would like to do something else. And so what's going on, you know, before you act out? And they're either bored, or they're lonely, or they're anxious, or they're angry, or they're upset. But oftentimes it also goes with opportunity. It's late at night, they're in the room by themselves or whatever. And I say, okay, so if you feel the trigger coming on, I mean, remember, your brain is already starting to go to work, because it's been conditioned. Every time I'm in this place, I end up masturbating. And so it's already kind of pumping out that dopamine and the norepinephrine, and it's kind of getting you ramped up, because that's what it's come to expect. But if you don't want to do that, and they'll look at me funny, I'll say, hold up the hand that you use when you masturbate. And they'll, okay. And they'll hold up their hand, and I'll say, okay, look at the five digits there. And one at a time, like one word for each of those digits, what do I really want? And so I have them like, you know, move those fingers. What do I really want? And so ask yourself that question. And like, before you act out, if you would say that the deepest desire of my heart and my core being as a person is to, you know, is to rub one off to porn, then I mean, I guess go ahead. But if there is an answer that might be deeper than that, then by acting out, what are you robbing yourself of? You're robbing yourself of the opportunity to get closer to what your heart is really looking for. And so it's not so much that you're losing out on an opportunity to do something that feels good, but in doing the thing that in the short term feels good, you're missing out on the opportunity to get something that's infinitely better. you know, it's like the Lewis quote that everybody quotes about, you know, being content to make mud pies when there's a vacation at the sea being offered. You know, we're far too easily pleased. And so when you were describing obedience, it's like, obedience is not about what it costs me. It's what it allows me to experience. And so if God says no to something, it's not because he doesn't want me to have good things. It's because he wants me to have good things.
Yes.
You know? And so like, what's the definition of what I need and what's really good? And as a, as an addicted person, I needed a serious recalibration of what was good and what I really needed.
Yeah. I love it. I love your hand exercise. And if it, you know, maybe repeat it at least, you know, however long it takes for that feeling and trigger to go away. Cause you know, it's going to be an awkward wank the other way. You've only got your offhand. Yeah,
you're going to be at least distracted while you're doing it this way.
Yeah.
I had a guy come back and say, thanks, you've ruined masturbation for me. I'm like, you're welcome.
Oh, I'm suddenly feeling some regret over using the phrase awkward wank, but you know, we're just going to stick with it. I'm standing by the truth of it.
Maybe that was somebody's nickname in junior high, and they think you're talking to them.
Well, Greg, how do people get in touch with you and what you're doing and find out about your intensives? Yeah. What's their porthole to you?
Yeah, thank you. AwakenRecovery.com. So that's our website, AwakenRecovery.com. We're located in Birmingham, Alabama, and the things that we offer are a lot of them are local to Alabama, but they're not all local. We have in-person and virtual meetings. We've actually got in-person meetings in about 7 different towns in Alabama and then one in Nashville, Tennessee. But we also have 3 virtual meetings at this point. We continue to add virtual meetings. And so I know Samson's got just a boatload of virtual meetings, which is incredible. We've got some of those as well. One of the things that we recommend strongly is that people who are seeking recovery from addictive or unwanted sexual behavior be working with a qualified therapist, whether that's somebody who's got specific certification in trauma or addiction. We think that's going to be the most helpful. But on top of that, a lot of people find it really helpful to do like a short term, like a weekend intensive where they kind of take a deep dive or a dive into the deep end of the pool where they, you know, get several months worth of therapy sessions kind of all in one weekend, and it connects the dots a lot faster and it kind of gives them clarity as to what they want to do next. We offer one called the Roots Retreat, and we do it once a quarter, February, May, August, and November. And so if people wanted to get information on where they could, how they could come to the Roots Retreat, they can find that information on our website as well. They can find out about meetings. They can find out about intensives. If you're a church leader and you want us to work with you to help you better understand sexual addiction and brokenness so that you can more effectively and graciously shepherd your people, we do that as well through an offering that we call ministry cohorts. So we've just got a bunch of different ways. I mean, if this is something that we believe the stats, it affects just as many people inside the church as outside. And so the people who are tasked as leaders and caregivers in the local church, they need to understand this too. And we cannot assume that they're being adequately trained in how to counsel addiction and betrayal trauma in seminary. And so to augment that with some, you know, continuing ed, a good way to do that, it would be to work with some people who do this all the time. And, you know, with my background, having been 15 years in church ministry, I know what it's like to be the one ministering to people. I know what it's like to be the one needing to be ministered to. I know the messages that church leaders say that make people feel unsafe. And I know how we could make people feel safer. We can at least set the table for people to confess and come forward and ask for help. And so ministry cohorts is actually one of the newer things we do. And it's one of the ones I'm more excited about. And I'm hoping for just more opportunities to connect with more church leaders for that.
Well, I love that you are taking the time and effort to build these 12-step tools on a gospel foundation, they aren't separate, but they're woven together, and that in the end, you don't just end up with a bunch of sober people, you end up with people who know their beloved of their father,
yeah,
and are learning to draw closer to Jesus.
Yeah, because just sober people, I would even call them abstinent people, not necessarily even sober in their minds or in their hearts. Mm-hmm. And so the 12 steps are so invaluable. They're so important and critical as a pathway to come to understand myself and God and my relationships better so that I can go under the surface and realize that it's about so much more than just behavior. So yeah, thank you for your kind words about that. That's definitely what we're trying to do.
Well, Greg Oliver, thank you for hanging out on this Wednesday afternoon. Whenever anybody's listening to it, it's Wednesday to us.
Of course. Thanks for talking with me, Aaron. Loved talking with you. Sorry I was hard to listen to. I'm getting over some laryngitis, but hopefully I wasn't too croaky today.
No, you sound sexy. And we will be right back on the Pirate Monk Podcast. All right, we are back on the Pirate Monk Podcast. We've got some stuff coming up, man.
Oh, we do. We do. Registration is now open for the Walk Through England, the walking retreat in England that starts in Oxford, couple nights in Oxford. We'll do an Inklings tour there and then take the train into the Cotswolds to have a walking retreat for a few days, one of the most beautiful parts of the world.
And all right, so where do people go to look at those details?
That's a good question.
Thank you.
I linked to a couple guys who already expressed interest. And so the two single rooms are already gone. Anybody, I think there's 5 slots left because there's going to be 10 people total. That's you and me and 8 other guys. That's where we're maxing it out.
So we call those the spooning rooms.
this is one of my favorite things to do, and it's just going to be a wonderful time. I'll tell spooning? You what.
I like spooning too.
You and I did share a king size bed at the retreat in Colorado last year.
Well, yeah, and I shared a bed with your brother in England last year. So
did you?
I feel okay, like I got right. The full Larkin experience.
Let's do this. I don't know exactly where this thing gets posted, and that's kind of out of my thing. So let's say this: if you're listening to this and you would like to go on this walking trip in England, which is from June 8th to June 16th, I think is the dates. Right away, send us shoot a note to piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com and say, hey, I'm interested. And I will send you the link to the registration page.
And beyond that, we also have been working on the annual retreat happening on the first weekend in November of 2024. You and I and Andrew Bowman, you and me and Andrew, I have to think about that. But anyways, we are going to be spending time doing personal work and then sending out some Silas groups. You're going to be talking with guys. We're kind of going retro with this year. Okay. It's going to be in North Carolina, and I know that registration has been posted in the Noble briefing, so if you have not received that, we can also send you that if you ask us for it at piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com, but it's going to be really fun to go to North Carolina.
And the nice thing, we got it set up this year, so that if you register now and set up for the payment deal, you can pay $20 a month and then it's paid. By the time the thing rolls around, you're all paid up. So you don't have to come up with a big chunk of change right now.
That is, we have tried to think of all the things you guys have sent us about what would keep you from it. So we've got airports close by. We're gonna make it as simple as possible for you to be there because, man, it is so great. This is one of my favorite weekends of the year. to get to see guys that I hang out with in virtual meetings and to watch other people connect. And if it's your first time, we are going to do special things to make sure that you have a group that you are hanging out with. Even if you think, yeah, I've never done meetings before, we're going to set you up. We're going to hook you up. We're going to have fun. It's going to be amazing.
And that is, this year, it's going to be the third weekend in November.
And it'll be third? Is it not the first?
It's not the first. No, we've switched it to the third. Third weekend in November.
Well, yeah. Okay. See? I'll need to write into piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com to get some information. Is that not like Thanksgiving?
No, it is actually the Thanksgiving is really late in November this year, so it'll be 2 weekends before Thanksgiving.
Okay, all right. I trust Nate implicitly, mostly.
Kind of, occasionally. All right. Well, hey, this has been great, Aaron. So great hearing your voice. And we've got, I've sent a list of potential guests, great guests, people that I had the privilege of spending time with over the last week to Justin. We're getting those scheduled. We got some other great guests on tap. So a lot of great conversation ahead in 2024 here on the Pirate Monk Podcast. Hey, we love to hear from listeners. We love your reactions. We love your suggestions. And of course, you can always reach us at piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com. Well, that's it for this week's show. Until next time, I'm Nate.
I'm Aaron.
And we are your pals on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Arrgh.
The Pirate Monk Podcast is produced by members of the Samson Society. Send your feedback or questions to piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com. Please give us a 5-star review on iTunes and share the podcast with a friend. For more information, please visit SamsonSociety.com.